the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. Once upon a time, there was a star named Ethel Merman. She was loud and funny and wonderful. Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, and George Gershwin wrote songs for her. Songs like There's No Business Like Show Business, I Got Rhythm, and I Get a Kick Out of You, all songs introduced by this legendary artist. Carol Flynn has written a great biography of this now somewhat forgotten Broadway star, Brass Diva, The Life and Legends of Ethel Merman. Carol Flynn, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
Dr. Flynn, why is Ethel Merman suddenly so obscure?
I don't know that I would fully agree with that. She is partially, I think the further you get from New York City, the obscurity quotient goes higher. When I was writing this book, I had, especially younger people too, say, yeah, I loved her in the I Love Lucy show. And they confuse her with Ethel Mertz. And actually, Vivian Vance and Ethel Merman had their careers intertwined in interesting ways. Or older folks would misremember her as, oh yeah, didn't she do all the swimming pictures? You know, Esther Williams. So, but at the same time, people usually know, what they know about Ethel Merman is a voice. And everyone will, at a drop of a dime, just go into an Ethel Merman imitation, just, you know, laying on the vibrato really thick. There's No Business Like Show Business. But it is curious that she's like not up in the forefront in terms of American pop history the way she should be, given, I mean, the Broadway, 20th century Broadway musical, without Ethel Merman, that history would implode. She just, as you said, introduced some of the most famous songs of it. So
to do with the nature of Broadway performing as opposed to television and movies.
That ephemerality really hit hard because the beginning of her career was before there were recording mechanisms. So, for instance, I saw some clandestinely shot silent black and white footage snuck in for Take a Chance, in 1932 Buddy DeSilva show she did with Jack Haley. And without the sound, it's kind of hard to know what's going on and all that. But the image I think most Americans have of her, and everyone has a different Ethel Merman. Some people just remember her as Gopher's mom on the Love Boat, those special episodes. And but a lot of people remember her from what was recorded were the endless TV guest appearances she did. She never got her own sitcom series. She tried twice and it was never picked up. And she would just bring herself all out there, just haul herself on stage and sing the same songs the same way with her really big hair and these big 70s caftans and everything. And so a lot of people, that's the Ethel Merman that they remember, the one with a pretty wide vibrato and the one that's kind of easy to camp up. But her early stuff was, that was really amazing, because I did find she did some one-reelers in the early 30s, some 5-10-minute shorts for Paramount, and where she'd get a chance to sing three songs, usually to show off different styles, jazz and a ballad and these kind of mini narratives. And her range was amazing. She, in one of them, she sings something close to operetta. You never expect that.
Well, and she was quite beautiful, I guess. I guess people look at her now and don't see the beauty, but I think she was very beautiful when she was younger.
She was pretty cute. I agree. She wasn't knock-you-down, cold, glamorous, but she was real. She had a twinkle in her eye that was just adorable. And there are some pictures of her in the 20s. She was born in 1908, and there's some really cute pictures of her from the late 20s and 30s, and she plays that glimmer in her eye for all it's worth. She would even, her singing style, she'd often raise her arms and draw attention to her twinkly eyes by wearing diamonds on her wrists and it was very smart on her part. She knew what her assets were.
Well, tell us a little bit about her early career. What were her first, with Broadway, where she first made an impact?
Well, her career is pretty mythic in terms of hitting Broadway, because she graduated high school as a stenographer and worked for a few years as a stenographer in Queens, where she was from, and then at night would sing at different establishments around the boroughs of New York. So she wasn't exactly an unknown, but she had never been on Broadway before, and George Gershwin discovered her via a relay of people initiated by Jimmy Durante, actually, and hired her as not even a second-string performer for his upcoming show, Girl Crazy, in 1930. And she sang, she just got, Ginger Rogers was the star, 19-year-old Ginger Rogers, and Ethel Merman just came out and sang I Got Rhythm. And when she held the note, high C on I in the chorus, she just held it and held it and held it. And people like later compared the feat to swimming the size of an Olympic pool four times without coming up for air. Peter Ustinov says the walls retreated 2 feet that night. But it was literally, she was literally an overnight sensation. I mean, the kinds of which are really hard to produce now. I mean, I'm thinking of Susan Boyle recently, but and the machinery that we're used to making stars usually takes a while to kick into gear. And Ethel was as close to the mythic truth of being an overnight sensation as they come. It was a pretty amazing story. She didn't even realize it at the time.
And how did it affect her personally when she became suddenly a star?
She kept her day job for a few years. And then when she realized that she was going to, this was a permanent gig, she quit and moved her parents and her into Manhattan. And she basically, the people who knew her the best say that she really held true to her roots. She would often hang out with the crew, play craps with them, and she had a mouth like a sailor too, and would tell dirty jokes to everyone. But she had this working class sensibility and sense of humor that really she kept with her all her life. Oh, and P.S., she also kept up her typing skills.
To be a stenographer or something.
I don't know about that. But she would type up like dinner menus when she would go to Cole Porter's elaborate parties, for instance. If he hadn't printed out a menu, she'd go home and type it out. Or she'd type out changes to scripts. It was amazing.
We're talking with Carol Flynn. And she's a professor of women's studies and media arts at the University of Arizona. She's written several books, and her latest, Brass Diva, The Life and Legends of Ethel Merman. I missed this when it was in hardcover last year, but I just discovered this wonderful paperback edition. I love this picture of her on the cover. Now, I know that Anything Goes was a big show for her, but the show that I want to ask you about, and I think like if I could go back in time, I'd want to see this show, was Red Hot and Blue, because it had her and Bob Hope and Jimmy Durante. Tell us a little bit about that play.
Well, it had a pretty crazy story to it. It just was, there were a couple of jailbirds, and Ethel Merman played their sponsor, and there were all these get-rich-quick schemes of holding a big lottery, and Bob Hope trying to find an old lover through the radio, and they could identify her by her having waffle burns on her rear end because he witnessed her sitting on a hot waffle. I mean, it was really kind of an insane story, but that didn't matter. It was the music was by Cole Porter, and it's not known as one of his. I mean, it wasn't Anything Goes, and unfortunately for Cole Porter, after Anything Goes in 1934, everything was compared to that, and it's kind of hard to beat that show. But the funniest story about Red Hot and Blue is that you didn't cross Ethel Merman, period, but you certainly didn't do it on stage. And Bob Hope, young comic, I mean, he and Ethel got along. In fact, Bob Hope would walk, he was living near Broadway too, and during the run he would pick up Ethel and they would walk to the theater together. But Bob Hope, being the ham that he was, decided to deliver some lines to Ethel, and Ethel had a crush on her character in the show. And he decided to deliver some of his lines to Merman while lying down to get some laughs at her expense.
Upstage.
And she did not take too kindly to that. Complained to the producers, and Miss Merman always got her way. And she threatened Bob Hope that if he tried something like that, she would flatten his ski nose even further.
One of my favorite songs, I think maybe my favorite recording of Ethel Merman's, is Down in the Depths on the 90th Floor. And that's from that show, Red Hot and Blue, I believe.
Yeah.
What a great song. It's such a wonderful ballad. She sings it so well.
Yeah.
It's not really the kind of song you would associate with her, but she sings it so beautifully.
The thing is, she does sing some beautiful ballads and bluesy numbers. She could really do the ballads and blues numbers and really heartbreaking songs. What's interesting is that as she matured and as her career progressed, in some ways the range of what she was permitted to do narrowed. And maybe that's not so unusual because, you know, people get hardened into a kind of certain kind of persona, and that really, really happened with her, and it happened with her vocally too. So that you everyone thinks of Merman with more anthemic songs like "There's No Business Like Show Business" or "Everything's Coming Up Roses," the kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps and these rousing songs, whereas some of the pieces you're talking about are really beautiful, beautiful ballads, and she could really sing them beautifully, but that's not what we associate with her. You know, you don't think of ballads or lullabies or...
Yeah, another one I think of when you mention that is I Got Lost in His Arms from Annie Get Your Gun. What a beautiful song that is.
Yeah, and people... critics gave her trouble for that because already by 1946, her image had hardened to the point where people were saying that song doesn't make sense for Ethel Merman, whereas You Can't Get a Man with a Gun from the same show
does. Right.
So, I mean, that was a real important transitional moment for her. I mean, she was moving into middle age, but that was the show that, as she always put it, where Irving Berlin made a lady out of me. Of course, the storyline is making a lady out of this Hickwater, you know, Annie Oakley, but it was the first one that allowed her to have romantic feelings that weren't a source of gags, mm-hmm. as they are like in Red Hot and Blue or something like, or her being the woman on the losing end of a relationship, a second-tier comic romantic partner. And so...
Right, the man that she loves in Annie Get Your Gun loves her also.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It works. Of course, she has to pretend that she can't shoot.
That's right. I guess there's some feminist issues in that story, but it's got so many great songs.
Oh, it does.
And not just for her, but I mean, I think a lot of the songs people don't know because they're not in the movie.
Yeah.
But songs like Who Do You Love, I Hope, and there's some sweet little Irving Berlin songs in that show. She didn't get the movie. Betty Hutton got the movie, and that sort of happened to her a lot. What happened with her as a movie actress?
Well, it is a series of kind of mini tragedies. There's a kind of mass consensus on this that the electrifying presence that she had on stage just didn't transfer onto the screen, whether it was the silver screen or the electronic TV screen. It just didn't work. There's also the difference. She had this old, almost a vaudevillian kind of performing style where you face the audience, plant your feet on the stage, and just deliver. And her comedy was like that, too. I mean, even if you see her in the 1960s comedy, It's Mad, 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 Mad World, she still has that kind of presence. It's a very physical, hard kind of fabulous presence.
She was hysterical in the movie.
She held her own against all these comics. It was really nice. But at the same time, she knew that she had limitations as a dramatic actress, for sure. But at the same time, the stuff just it didn't work. And then there was also the complication that she didn't meet... Hollywood's always been a more conservative institution or industry than Broadway, and certainly for women, Hollywood likes them to be
young
more glamorous
and
blonde and without a queen's accent and without looking so tough and being a lot thinner. So they never really knew what to do with her. There's some very funny Hollywood photos of them trying to gussy her up in various ways and make her look, you know, put her in blonde hair or make her look like Tallulah Bankhead, and it kind of looks like Ethel's in drag, actually. But Broadway has a lot of shows about offbeat women and will celebrate offbeatness in general, whereas Hollywood, especially at the height of the studio era, which is when she lived, was harder to crack, and she never cracked it. She was the only movie where she kept her stage role was Call Me Madam from the early 50s.
Right.
And she's great in that, but it just didn't...
A successful film, really.
No, and Fox put a lot of money into it, and so they were not as enthusiastic about her contract with them as she was.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Carol Flynn, the author of Brass Diva, The Life and Legends of Ethel Merman. Let me ask you about Gypsy. You know, recently Patti LuPone and Bernadette Peters have revived it on Broadway. But it's her show. It was written for her. Stephen Sondheim wrote not the music, but the lyrics. I understand that she didn't like Stephen Sondheim's music. Is that true?
Well, it was less that than at that point Sondheim wasn't a very established composer, and so she didn't want to take that risk, because the last show she'd done was 3 years ago, Happy Hunting, which was the only the closest thing to a bomb that she was in. It wasn't technically a bomb, but it didn't do too well. She called it a Jeep among limousines. And she had famous fights with her co-star Fernando Lamas, and the songwriters were former dentists, one of them was a former dentist. They did the score. And so she really wanted experience. And so they went with Julie Stein, who, and he also, in terms of his composing style, is a much simpler composer and is very good for doing like memorable choruses and things like this. But Julie Stein does these, he's a much simpler composing style. And Sondheim is a much more complex composer, but she wasn't willing to take that risk. And so she insisted that Sondheim be taken off of the music. And so Sondheim found a way to work with Stein. And Stein was used to composing for particular voices. And so what Sondheim kind of learned from his elder there was to, you know, write what you want, but make sure that you're writing it for Ethel Merman's voice, with that voice in mind.
And was Gypsy a smash at the time of its initial production?
It was very successful. It was a bigger critical triumph than it was a commercial success, although it was very, very strong. But it didn't win the Tony. She lost to Sound of Music, Mary Martin playing Maria von Trapp. When she lost the Tony to her, she said, "Oh, how do you buck 'em, none?" You know. But they did have higher hopes, and but Gypsy did very well. It was a success. It wasn't smash, smash, smash the way that like Hello, Dolly would be, but.
And again, she lost the movie part to Rosalind Russell, which I don't understand.
Nobody does. That was really, I think that was a really awful thing. And it clearly got under her skin, because Merman famously never toured with a show. And Gypsy, which was her last original show that she did, when the Broadway run went over, she said that she was going to take it on the road. She would travel with it to show people how it ought to be done, which I think was her response to Roz Russell getting the part in a pretty underhanded way, because Hollywood, Warner Brothers, was in negotiations with Merman and her agent for the film part, and then Rosalind Russell's husband, whom Ethel called the Wizard of Oz, Wizard of Roz, was able to secure a deal for his wife, and in a very backhanded manner. So, and Russell didn't end up singing the soundtrack to it. So yeah,
somebody dubbed her voice.
Yep.
Yeah, it's crazy. Who knows what goes on in Hollywood?
One of life's little tragedies. Yes. No, it really was awful, and it bothers everybody, except Roz Russell fans.
Are there any still? No, I love Roz Russell. She's great. And
she's fabulous, but she's not a musical star.
That wasn't a good film of hers. I like
His
Girl Friday
film.
And stuff.
Oh, His Girl Friday is the best.
But let's talk a little bit about her private life. I guess one of the most famous or infamous events in her life was her marriage to Ernest Borgnine. They were married for like 20 minutes or something.
Yeah, 20 days.
Was she an unhappy person, or?
No, she wasn't. She wasn't a very introspective person, for sure. She proudly said she didn't read books. Her level was magazines, Variety, and things like that. She wasn't very introspective. She was very direct. She was vulnerable, but never in a way that a lot of people would recognize. The confidence that she had about her professional life, I'm not so sure spilled over into her personal life. I mean, Ernie Borgnine was her fourth of four marriages. Her first marriage was also less than a year to a talent agent from Hollywood named Bill Smith. Can't get much more generic than that. And that was a rebound relationship for Merman. And then her second husband was a journalist named Bob Levitt, who worked for the Hearst Corporation. And it was with Levitt that she had her two children. And that was about as close to familial happiness as she as she got for that 7 years, but it was, by the end, a very unhappy marriage. She was a heavy drinker, and Levitt was an outright alcoholic and faced a lot of depression, actually ended up killing himself in the late 50s, sometime after their divorce, and he'd been remarried. Then her third husband was Robert Six, who was the CEO and founder of Continental Airlines, and that was a big event because the marriage to, I mean, she was a power hitter herself, and he was too, very charismatic, domineering kind of person, just like she was. But with him, she left New York to live in Denver for 7 years to play Hausfrau, and that didn't work. And I think for me that one of the biggest surprises in learning about her personal life, and this isn't as campy and fun as the weird 3-week marriage to Ernie Borgnine, even though she really loved him at first. But at any rate, the sixth marriage was quite tragic because her surviving child, Bob Levitt Jr., reported to me how much he beat her, and he beat her parents, and was a very violent man. And it's very hard to put the public image of Merman as the toughest broad in the world, to reconcile that image with the image of a victim of domestic violence. And so that was pretty astonishing. So she was quite distrustful of men after that, and there were financial abuses as well. And so the relationship with Borgnine in the mid-60s was, you know, getting back into the seat again. And for as incongruous as the pairing was, you know, Broadway's royalty with, you know, Marty from the movie of the same name, her son says, sure feelings, and I imagine Borgnine's too, were very, very sincere. And they both had this kind of working class persona that made sense. And people I talked to who were very close to the family said that they were a touching couple. But something happened in the honeymoon, and Ethel never talked about it with anyone. And until his recent book, written just in this last year or two, Borgnine didn't either, about what went wrong. Ethel's family and associates are convinced it had something with money. There are rumors of domestic violence and sexual abuses or misconduct or whatever. I feel like I will never know. But Borgnine is now saying, and another school of thought is that they were jealous over each other's successes, which certainly wasn't the case when they were being interviewed together. But anyway, it was a very volatile and abrupt ending. They didn't even finish the honeymoon.
Oh, my gosh.
It's really amazing.
Did they ever speak again, or we don't know?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, just through their lawyers.
And at the time of Ethel Merman's death, I remember that they dimmed the lights on Broadway, and it was quite a thing when she died.
It was. There were plans in the works for naming Broadway Theater after her. They fell through, but Broadway wouldn't. I mean, Broadway kind of stands on Ethel Merman's shoulders in a lot of ways, and you can't write the history of Broadway without her. And in some ways, Ethel Merman, her life intertwines even with those that she never worked officially. She didn't work in a Richard Rodgers show, Rodgers and Hammerstein show, but he was the producer of Annie Get Your Gun. They were the producers of Annie Get Your Gun. So, I mean, her career connects with everyone from about 1930 to 1980, which is includes Broadway's golden musical era.
Well, the book is called Brass Diva, The Life and Legends of Ethel Merman. It's a very well written and beautifully done, well researched book, and the author is Dr. Carol Flynn. Thank you so much for joining us on From the Bookshelf.
No, thank you.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, I hope you'll check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. Thanks, as always, go to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Ms. Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP and From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.